Thank you, Subhadra, and a very good evening to you all. It's often interesting to see the sort of reactions that people have when you tell them that you're a Buddhist. Sometimes the other person will be sympathetic and will say, "How interesting." And they will go on to ask you what being a Buddhist means, and you can soon find yourself in the midst of an interesting and useful discussion. At other times, when someone hears that you are a Buddhist, they will soon ask you, "Why don't you have a shaved head and wear yellow robes? Do you beg?" I've even on one notable occasion had somebody say to me, "How can you be a Buddhist? You're wearing trousers." Even with the most sympathetic of people, almost inevitably, in the course of the discussion, the following kind of assertion will be made. "Buddhism is an Eastern religion. You are a Westerner. You're an Englishman. Buddhism isn't really meant for the West. It's not meant for England. It's not part of our culture." These kinds of questions and assertions all derive, of course, from the mistaken identification with Buddhism and Eastern culture. This isn't really very surprising. Buddhism, after all, did originate in the East. It originated in India in 500-odd BC with the Buddha. And it spread all over Asia, where it had a long and glorious history, becoming an integral part of the various cultures of the East, which I should add are all very different. But it's quite wrong to identify the essence, the fundamental principles of Buddhism with Eastern culture, just as it is quite wrong to identify Buddhism with any one particular Eastern culture. Buddhism is a universal teaching. Its essential principles are for all men and all women at all times. Though these principles will be expressed in a manner suitable to the particular culture in which they find themselves. We can see an illustration of this in the Buddhist art of the East. If you're familiar with it, you'll bear with me. Compare, for example, the rich, highly devotional, even at times quite sensual, Indian Buddhist frescoes with the cool, essential details of Chinese Buddhist art, often depicting the very essence of a bamboo in just a few short, sharp strokes. Both in their way express essential Buddhist insights, but both are strikingly different, for those insights are expressed through a particular sensibility, which is the product of a particular culture. In the last 100 or so years, Buddhism has come to the West, to Europe, the Americas, and Australasia. At first, it was only known to a very few, select Orientalists, academics, and eccentrics. But gradually, and especially in the last 20 years, it has become a practical way of life for a growing number of people. And those people are practicing their Buddhism as part of their Western culture and civilization. So that we are now finding that a Western Buddhism is beginning to emerge. What some of the features of that Western Buddhism are, we can look at a bit later on. First of all, it might be an idea if we try to understand what Buddhism in its essence is. We have to answer the question, what is Buddhism? It would seem that even in the Buddha's lifetime, this question, what is Buddhism, came up. It came up in the mind of one of the Buddha's women disciples, a woman disciple, moreover, who was, before the Buddha became the Buddha, his aunt and foster mother. Her name was Gotami. In the early days of her Buddhist life, she found herself in some doubt as to what was Buddhism. She had been to many of the Buddha's most eminent disciples, who had all told her, each one of them, in different ways, different things as to what constituted Buddhism. So she found herself wondering what particular course to follow. Was it this teaching or that teaching, this meditation or that meditation? This doubt, this confusion, became so great that in the end she went to the Buddha and asked him, in effect, what is Buddhism? What is it in its essence? And the Buddha replied as follows. I hope you'll bear with me because I'm just going to quote a little bit from the Buddhist scriptures. The Buddha's reply went like this. Of whatever teachings you can assure yourself in this way, these teachings lead to calmness, not to neurotic passion, to freedom, not to bondage, to a decrease of worldly entanglements, not to increase of them, to individuality, not to immersion in the group, to delight in the skillful, not in the unskillful. Of such teachings, you may affirm with certainty, this is Buddhism. It's a very interesting, a very significant sort of reply. Before we go on to consider some of its content, let's just consider its tone. Its first sentence runs, of whatever teachings you can assure yourself. You can assure yourself. This is an important phrase. It's a key phrase in Buddhism. Because a phrase like that, you can assure yourself, asks us to be our own judge of what constitutes Buddhism. The responsibility, the initiative, is given to us. The Buddha doesn't ask us to believe in a particular dogma or that we perform certain observances. He asks us to examine our own experience, to assess what we find ourselves. He respects our intelligence, our integrity. He has, if you like, faith in humanity, faith in its capability of recognizing something for itself. Having established that any assessment of Buddhism must come out of our own experience and understanding, he goes on to list certain qualities which are characteristically Buddhist. Again, I should stress, these qualities aren't articles of faith. They are, you could say, the description of certain flavours that go to make up the characteristic Buddhist taste. Let's just take a look at one or two of these flavours, these qualities. We can then see more definitely what Buddhism is. Let's look at the qualities of individuality and skillfulness and try to see them not in the abstract, but in terms of our own experience. So first of all, individuality. What did the Buddha mean when he used this word individuality? What do we mean when we use the word individuality? If we take a good, long, and quite hard look at ourselves, and quite honest look at ourselves, it doesn't take much to see that we have been formed by a great many external factors, which we could see in terms of different kinds of human groups. We could see these external factors in terms of different kinds of human groups. Our feelings, our thoughts, our attitudes are a kind of inheritance from such groups as our nation, our family, our class, our school, our workplace, our circle of friends, our religion, and so on. If we look hard, if we look really hard, it can sometimes be difficult to discern anything that really is us, of which we could really say, this is unique, this is me, this is my individuality. This exists apart from all that, from all those groups. This exists independently. This can really come home to us if we try living in another country with a very different culture. I remember in this connection the difficulty I had when I lived in India. I went there to teach Buddhism to Indians. There you see an example of the universality of Buddhism. English Buddhists teaching Indian Buddhists. It's a very interesting and very interesting sort of story, but another sort of story. But when I got to India, I found to my surprise to my shock, I discovered just how much I was a product of my country and its values. In just about every aspect of life, it was brought home to me just how much my strength, my initiative, my happiness, just how much me depended on dear old England, dear old Blighty. It took some time to adjust. It's quite striking in such situations how the tiniest things assume an enormous importance. How, for example, a cafe selling tea in the traditional English manner, in a pot with a jug of milk and a strainer and a cup and saucer, how all that assumes a quite unnatural importance. So living abroad can bring home to us this lack of individuality. Somebody also at one time once suggested, I don't think this person was necessarily a Buddhist, it's just somebody, they once suggested that we attempt to find out just exactly how much we really do know. That one day we just sit down with a piece of paper and we just start to write down how much we know from first-hand experience. How many things are there can we claim to really know? How much is our knowledge derived from books, newspapers, television, radio, from other people? How much is our knowledge given to us? And if this is true of our knowledge, surely that must affect how we see the world. Do we really see it for what it is? Or do we in fact see somebody else's picture of it, or a picture of somebody else's picture, and so on ad infinitum? These kind of considerations make us wonder just how much we live our life from out of ourselves and from out of our own understanding and experience. It is interesting, and I think useful, to consider how much our happiness, our knowledge, our power, such as they are, derive from our immersion in a group of people. Of course, we can and do sense that we are more than just a product of a group. We sense that there is something different, something unique, something special in us, and that life is indeed more than it seems, and that other people are indeed more than they seem. It would also appear that we are always being given hints to remind us of that something more, that uniqueness. If we took the hint, if we just paid attention to it, our notion of life could change radically. That hint might come to us from the pages of a book, from a line of poetry. It might come to us in a few bars of music. It might come to us when we hear the wind as it rustles the leaves of a tree. Or we might get that hint when we have a really deep conversation with a close friend. It could come, in fact, from anything. In fact, even the most unexpected of circumstances. For example, a friend of mine told me a couple of weeks ago that when he was a young boy, one summer evening, he sat on the steps leading to the door of his house, eating a plate of dripping sandwiches. The sun was setting, and the sky was turning a deep and beautiful pink, the clouds becoming a dappled purple. As he sat, eating his dripping sandwiches, everything seemed to take on a profundity. Everything seemed to reveal a deep and mysterious meaning, an ineffable meaning, but a meaning that he felt had to be discovered. He said at the time, and of course he was a young boy, that he wondered if his experience had anything to do with eating dripping sandwiches. But as his life unfolded, he gradually realised that what it was to do with was his own emergent uniqueness, his own emergent individuality. We need then to emerge. We need to emerge from the group, from the mass, from our inheritance. Our position is perhaps like some of Michelangelo's sculptures. Some of you may know those sculptures that Michelangelo created that depict a figure emerging from a shapeless mass of stone. The shapeless mass would seem to be taking form before us, before our very eyes. Sometimes it seems to be taking form with obvious effort and even strain. Sometimes, though, as in a figure I've seen of St. Matthew emerging from a lump of stone, it seems to be emerging with an ecstasy, a bliss. These figures moving out of the stone are alive and fluid and would seem even to be escaping from the indefinite, dead and static mass. We are perhaps like this, emergent beings. But there is, of course, a difference. The difference is that we are not only the figure forming itself from out of the mass, we are also the artist who will form it. There is no Michelangelo who will form us. We are our own Michelangelo. We create ourselves. To be an individual means that we create ourselves and recreate ourselves at all times. And the self we create and recreate is more unique, more individual than the time before. This really is what Buddhism is. The constant recreation of ourselves at every moment, in every situation. If you have ever felt that need to create yourself, you may well have looked to certain people, men and women, who insisted on creating themselves, who asserted in their words and deeds the importance of such an attitude to life. But it wasn't enough to just accept things as they are. We all have our heroes and heroines in this respect. They might be saints, artists, writers, musicians, philosophers, scientists, statesmen, or even just ordinary men and women who throughout time, up even to the present day, have insisted on creating themselves. Sometimes even under hostile conditions. These we can look to as an example, as an ideal. For Buddhists, the example, the ideal in this respect, is the Buddha. Although Buddhists look for their inspiration to anybody who in their life seeks to create themselves, they find in the Buddha the supreme exemplar of such creating. The Buddha's life depicts clearly and unambiguously the life of the individual. The Buddha isn't seen as a kind of God, or as the son of God, or as a prophet of God. There is, in fact, no God in Buddhism. The Buddha is seen as man recreated, man perfected, but recreated and perfected to such a degree that he would seem to transcend what we usually think of as the human. That degree of recreation is known as enlightenment, from which the word Buddha, which means enlightened one, is taken. We will take a look at enlightenment in just a moment, but before we do, it's important to appreciate that the Buddha himself started off in the same position as ourselves. He had the same passions, the same delusions. He too began life immersed in the group. He was born the son of a wealthy and powerful leader of a small republic in northern India. And he was thus trained as a warrior and as a leader. And it would have seemed that he would have gone the way of his father. But that sense of his own uniqueness, wouldn't allow him to do that. Like that friend of mine who described the experience he had as a boy as he sat on his doorstep. The Buddha, when he was a boy, had, as he sat not on a doorstep, but beneath a flowering tree, he too had this sort of experience. As he sat there, he was watching his father plough the land. And as he watched, the world seemed to unfold before him, revealing its glorious inner nature and meaning. At the same time, he felt an abundant happiness and bliss. And this experience had a lasting effect. He never forgot it. And the effect prompted him to want to cast off the ties of the group. So in his late 20s, his early 30s, after much thought, much consideration, much weighing of the pros and cons, he decided to throw off those group ties, to leave his family, to leave his homeland, and follow the hint he had been given. As was the custom in those days, he left his home, his family, his friends, his future power, and took the rough roads of the wanderer. In later life, he described the difference between the group life and the individual life as the difference between a life that was cramped and so static that it just gathered dust, and a life that was wide open as the blue sky. Only in that kind of freedom could he discover where that sense of uniqueness could take him. We sometimes, I think, feel like that ourselves. We too may well have felt on occasion that the group or groups to which we belong restrict us. Of course, it might not be possible for us to leave home so dramatically as the Buddha did. Our responsibilities might not let us. But we can at least cast off the attitude of the group, leave that behind. But such a departure from the group does itself give us quite a responsibility. If we decide to make our own way, it means that we, and only we, are responsible for what we do. We are answerable for our own mistakes. We cannot hide any longer in the group. We cannot pass the buck, as they say. Living as an individual is not the same, therefore, as living as an individualist. An individualist is someone who strikes the pose of being free of the group, with the pretense of uniqueness, which usually takes the form of offending the group quite deliberately. Yet the drives, the attitudes of the individualist are the same as those of the group. How many rebels without causes have ended by conforming? The individual has a sense of responsibility, including a sense of responsibility for the effect he has on others. The Buddha didn't just leave home. After gaining enlightenment, he passed his discoveries on to other people, including that of his own family. But before gaining enlightenment, it was a question of taking responsibility for his own life. He made mistakes. He corrected those mistakes. It was a matter of trial and error, of experimenting with himself. And it was a matter of effort. It's an interesting story, but we haven't got time to go into it now. But eventually, he discovered just what it was he sought. He attained what is known as supreme perfect enlightenment, the state of ultimate recreation, which is attainable by anybody willing to make the effort to attain it. Enlightenment consists of three essential qualities. Firstly, there is wisdom. Wisdom is the constant awareness and penetrating insight into the true nature of life. Secondly, there is love. Love, in this sense, is the imaginative identification with all life and the overwhelming and practical compassion that arises out of it for all living beings. And thirdly, there is energy, by which is meant the spontaneous, unforced, creative activity which delights in making available to all the means by which they may become an individual, and the means by which the quality of life generally will be improved. This last quality, energy, underlines the fact that enlightenment isn't a static state. One never in fact stops creating. Even if we reached a personal perfection, the fact that others hadn't would inspire us to do everything we could to help them. So something is characteristically Buddhist if it leads to the forming from out of the mass our individuality. An individual is the artist of his own life, giving that life a beautiful, a noble definition, which uplifts all who can see it. Now, an artist needs, as well as his own vision of possibilities, skill. And you may remember that one of those characteristically Buddhist qualities the Buddha referred to was skillfulness. Skillfulness has a definite meaning in Buddhism, and that meaning constitutes the best way we can go about forming our individuality. We are acting skillfully if our actions, whether of body, speech or mind, and mind here refers to feelings and emotions as well as to thoughts, we're acting skillfully if our actions proceed from contentment, friendliness and awareness, as well as from such things as generosity and compassion and so on. If we act continually from this sort of basis, then we can be sure that we will create ourselves. We really will be developing our individuality. We really will be leaving the group. We are acting unskillfully if we do the opposite of this. If our actions proceed from a basis of greediness, hatred and unawareness, and of their rather ugly relations, which I won't go into, we will not create an individuality. These unskillful states are the drives of the mass, the group. One glance at history, at the wars caused by them and perpetuated by them, is enough to see how unhelpful they really are. I should also just mention that the words skillful and unskillful are not substitutes in Buddhism for the words good and evil. If we do happen to be unskillful, that is not an occasion for breastbeating and thinking what a terrible sinner we are. We simply realise that we have made a mistake, see why we have made it, and continue with the important task of creating ourselves. Now, it is not enough to proclaim the need for us to create ourselves through the cultivation of skillful states. We must have a method of actually cultivating them. The most direct method is meditation, and Buddhism is rich in meditation practices. There are literally thousands of meditation practices in Buddhism, all catering for the needs of different individuals. But all of them are concerned with the development of skillful states. Meditation is the most direct way of developing these states, because in meditation, the mind is working on itself, working with itself, or working in itself, if you like. The mind is actually seeking to recreate itself. The two most important meditation practices for Buddhism are what are known as the mindfulness of breathing and the development of universal friendliness. In the mindfulness of breathing, we recreate ourselves through learning to concentrate on our breath. Through practice, the mind becomes still and calm, but not inert. The stillness is brilliantly awake and alive, like a brilliant white light that illumines everything clearly and burns up greed, hatred, and the other unskillful states. In the other practice, the development of universal friendliness, we learn to overcome our petty dislikes and utter indifference by developing an intense friendliness for all beings. This friendliness is no mere sentiment, but a strong and driving emotion that causes us to act with friendliness as well. There are other ways of developing skillful states and thus create our individuality, but these other ways can be described as indirect methods because they work on our mind through, as it were, an intermediary. We can use these indirect methods in conjunction with meditation. I'll just mention some of these indirect methods. There is Hatha Yoga, a physical discipline which tones up our body and which obviously has a good effect on our minds. There is the study of Buddhist principles and the theory of meditation. This kind of study is not of the dry, academic, purely theoretical variety. It is the practice of gaining a clear and unambiguous understanding of the principles and methods by which we create our individuality. Through gaining such an understanding, we can see what we need to do and so act more effectively. This kind of study can be done alone, but it's much more effective within a group of people where you can each compare notes with one another. There is also the keen and vigorous appreciation of the arts. I won't, in fact, say anything about this, as it is the subject of next week's talk. There is also right livelihood, or a creative working life. Again, I'm not going to say anything about this, because it's the subject of, not the next talk, but the one after. Another very important indirect method is friendship. By friendship, I mean the kind of relationship that arises between people who seek to create themselves. It is characterized by the willingness of those involved in it to do whatever they can to help and encourage each other to create their individuality. This sort of friendship, especially when it exists between a large number of people, is a major source of good to the world, for it is naturally expansive and it wants to include everybody in it. By now, you can see that these methods, direct and indirect, and there are more, add up in their way to a whole lifestyle, even to a whole world. They in fact add up to the whole lifestyle, the whole world of Buddhism. They are the main features of Buddhism, and they are the main features of Western Buddhism also. All of them, meditation, study, appreciation of the arts, right livelihood and friendship, are all available here at this centre. Now, I began this talk by pointing out that Buddhism is a universal teaching, its principles being for all men and all women and at all times. And I hope I've managed to communicate those principles to you. I have spoken of them primarily in terms of creating an individuality, of moulding and forming ourselves out of our as yet shapeless clay. We establish principles by which we live out of our particular way of seeing the world, our particular vision of the world. In the West, over the centuries, we have been used to seeing the world, of seeing man, in certain ways, which have given rise to certain principles by which we've lived our lives. We've been used to seeing man for a long time as intrinsically evil, as a fallen being. Or more recently, we've come to see him as a bundle of neuroses or as an economic unit. I would like to conclude this talk with Buddhism's way of seeing man. This way of seeing a man comes from the Buddha's vision as he looked out on the world at the time of his enlightenment. He saw all the beings of that world like lotus flowers. If you don't know what a lotus is, it's rather like our water lily, but much bigger and much brighter of colour. He saw all beings then as lotus flowers growing in a gigantic lake. Some of the flowers were but buds, tightly closed to the warmth and light of the sun, but others were beginning to open, revealing their unique colour, their unique shade. The Buddha's vision of man was of a sea of unique beings capable of development, capable through their own efforts of unfolding, of emerging into the light of truth, of love, of eternal happiness. Such a vision presents us all with the possibility of creating, of forming ourselves. Thank you.